And now we're in for a real treat. It's the author of one of my favourite books from last year. I think he and the book are terrific. Some years ago, we interviewed Jonathan Haidt about the book he'd written, The Righteous Mind. And today, we're going to interview him about the new book, The Coddling of the American Mind. It's a great book, and anyone who's concerned about freedom of speech, anyone who's worried that you can't say something because someone might be offended, and anyone in particular who's worried about how we're bringing our kids up, needs to get this book, The Coddling of the American Mind. Jonathan Haidt, famous author, welcome back to Counterpoint.
Well, thank you so much, Amanda. It's great to be back.
I've read the book. It's a great read. Let's start with university campuses and what's been going on over the last, say, decade, maybe a bit more, in terms of students wanting to feel safe. I think you and I agree everyone should feel physically safe. That is, they're not going to get gunned down, sexually molested, or whatever. But it's gone further than that, hasn't it?
That's right. Around 2013 or 2014, students started speaking in a way that took a lot of us by surprise. Students have been politically active for a long time. They've protested speakers. They've even shouted them down in the 1960s, a bit in the 1990s. So there's a new wave of political activism that began around 2014. But the thing that we had never seen before was students medicalizing speech. That is saying, not just, we need to shut him down because he's terrible, he's horrible, but we need to shut him down because it will damage us, it will cause trauma. There was an idea that students are fragile, and so many Australians by now will have heard of safe spaces, microaggressions, trigger warnings. All of these things are designed to protect students who are thought to be vulnerable from ideas that are thought to be dangerous or harmful to them. And this took us all by surprise. It came sweeping in, and most of us didn't understand what was going on. Greg Lukianoff is the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, advocating for student free speech rights. He noticed it right away because for the first time, he was hearing students asking for protection. It wasn't the administrators putting on restrictions to avoid lawsuits. It was students asking for protection. So that's the origin of the book, that mystery. Where did this come from and what does it mean?
Yeah, there are some examples out there of where students appear to have gone looking for offence and taken offence at emails that have, to a reasonably objective mind, been sent around to try and make the peace. And then they found themselves sort of barricaded in their rooms and the police having to be called. Have you got some examples of that?
Yes. So the key term here is a call-out culture, a culture in which students get prestige, they get social prestige for identifying something that they then label or tag as racist, sexist, homophobic, or otherwise insensitive to one of the seven or so major protected groups on American college campuses. And so one of the examples we talk about in the book was one of the early, really dramatic examples was a dean at Claremont McKenna College in Los Angeles who sent a very positive, I mean, you read the email, a student of Mexican descent had written an article about how marginalized she felt. She didn't feel welcome. She felt she didn't fit in. And a dean sent her an email. It's a very helpful email. And she says, I'd love to talk to you about this. This matters a lot to us in the dean of students' office. We especially want to help students who don't fit our CMC mold. Now, the student read the email, posted it on Facebook, and said, I guess I just don't fit that CMC mold. Feel free to share. The campus erupted in protest. Students went on hunger strike until she was fired. And to the rest of us, we're reading this, we're saying, what on earth is happening? What did she do wrong? Well, it turns out that the student took the email in the worst possible way. Anyone else who reads it would think it's obvious this dean is trying to be helpful. But if you're looking to call someone out, if you're looking to earn prestige by identifying someone as racist and then calling the Furies down on them, you could say, maybe she's saying, I don't fit the mold. Maybe this dean is saying, I should leave. Now, that's a kind of a level of paranoia that seems strange to the rest of us. And that's kind of the point. What Greg Lukianoff noticed is that students were beginning to do exactly the cognitive distortions that he had learned not to do when he learned cognitive behavioral therapy. Greg is prone to depression and suicidal thinking, and he credits CBT with saving his life. And in 2013, 2014, he saw students thinking and talking about speech just as he had thought and talked about life in his own head in 2008. That's what our book is about. Where did this disordered thinking come from? What is it doing to us on campus and to the speech climate everywhere in America now? And how can we get out of it?
So in effect, what you say is happening, and there's certainly plenty of, I say anecdotal evidence, not to diminish it, but because I don't have any more than that, that students and others are out to see the worst in things, and seeing the worst means seeing the speaker as a perpetrator of evil, and therefore the student or listener as the victim who's being attacked.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So first, let's put some constraints around this, because we write about moral panics, and we don't want to start a moral panic of our own. So what we're seeing nationally, which is true at universities across the country and in the UK as well, is a rise of anxiety disorders and depression. So American and British students, I don't know about Australians yet, but American and British students are much more prone to depression and anxiety now. That's everywhere. Campus mental health centers are overwhelmed. In the United States, they're not politicizing it everywhere. So I've spoken at a lot of schools now, and at a lot of schools, you find little events like this, but they don't blow up. It's mostly in the Northeast and the West Coast, that is the really deeply politically progressive areas, where this fragility and this depression talk is turned to political purposes to fight the culture war. And that's one of the six contributing factors to this sudden emergence of this new speech culture, is this horrible left-right culture war that's putting us all at each other's throats. So I don't want to give the sense that American college students have been nabbed by a virus that is eating their brains. It's mostly at our elite schools in the most progressive areas.
Mm. I'm talking with Jonathan Haidt, author of The Coddling of the American Mind. Well, Charles Murray, a prominent conservative thinker, and one of the academics accompanying him, the administrators of the university, were forced off campus. And I understand the administrator wasn't in hospital for 6 months, but had to have treatment for 6 months following that, because
she just got
out of hand.
That's right. Charles Murray wrote a book suggesting that race differences are obviously, of course, partly environmental, but he said the evidence suggests that they might be partly genetic as well. And that was in the 1990s. And so he was very controversial then. He then wrote a very important book on why America is coming apart by social class. This is one of the most important things that anyone needs to understand, how Trump got elected. And he was due to speak about that book in March of 2017, right after Trump was inaugurated. It's very much the sort of thing that students should be interested in and probably would have been interested in. But because there's a kind of a religious nature to this new morality, that is, there are blasphemy laws, there are sacred values, there are sacred groups. The world is divided into good and evil. So Murray was subject to blasphemy laws, meaning he was not allowed to speak on the campus, on the Middlebury campus. I don't mean by the administration. The administration did pretty well in trying to get him to speak. But some of the students acted like it was a religious violation. And it's fascinating to watch the video. If your listeners were to Google Middlebury Charles Murray protest, what you see is kind of like a ritual, a rite, with a lot of singing and chanting and sloganeering. And what the students are demanding as they're shouting him down, what they're demanding is not that he be moved somewhere else, but that he has to be moved off campus. He can give his talk as long as it's off campus, because that would pollute the campus if he were on it.
What this tells us is that not only at universities, but we see it in kids as well, are being told it's a dangerous world out there. You have to be protected from it. And I worry that it's making children even more apprehensive. You know, when I was a kid, my brother and two sisters were allowed to walk, I don't know, two or three blocks down to see an auntie, and we all had to hold hands and stick together and, you know, not get into cars with strangers. But kids aren't allowed to walk to school today. What are the things we can teach young people, and I'm thinking particularly primary school children, to make them more resilient, to make them get up and be people who go to university, who can handle someone having a different view?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That gets to the heart of the problem. In 2015, when Greg and I wrote our article about what was happening on campus, we thought that college campuses were making students weak, but we were wrong. The problem is baked in by the time they get to college. In the United States, we lost our minds in the 1980s and 1990s. It's true we had a big crime wave in the 1970s and 80s, and so there was some reason to be fearful, but the crime wave ended rather suddenly in the 1990s. And just as it was ending, just as American life became very safe again, physically quite safe, we freaked out about children being abducted. And we got the idea that if you ever take your eyes off your kid, he or she will be snatched. That almost never happens in this country. If you leave your kid in a car and go into the supermarket, someone calculated you'd have to leave him there for 700,000 years before he would be likely to be snatched at present rates. But because we have denied kids the independence that they need, beginning around the age of 8 or so, 6 to 8, kids go out into the world, they play in groups, they explore their neighborhood. That was always the case until the 1990s. We then freaked out, locked them up, and said, no, you have to always be supervised. And that means there's always an adult to settle disputes. We told them, if you see something, say something, the world is dangerous, always get an adult. And guess what? We made them morally dependent. That is, they can't solve their own moral conflicts. We denied them the learning. So now when they come to college, they're morally dependent. And if a speaker is going to come that they don't like, they demand that a dean or somebody disinvite the speaker. So instead of actually
protecting them and making them stronger, by overprotecting them, we've in fact made them weaker.
Exactly. The most important single word I can give you in Australia is the word anti-fragile. It was a word invented by Nassim Taleb, the guy who wrote The Black Swan, because there are certain systems in our world that actually require that they be challenged or shocked or knocked over in order to learn. And so the immune system is the best example. If you protect your kid from bacteria and dirt and you don't let them play in the dirt, you're actually weakening him or her. You're preventing the immune system from developing. Social life is the same. If you protect your kid, if you say, no teasing in this school, we will not allow kids to tease. We will not allow anybody to exclude anyone else. My kids go to New York City public schools, and they don't take it quite to that extreme. But they do ban exclusion, and they do actually more or less ban teasing. If you do that, then kids don't have a chance to develop an immune system, a social immune system, to being teased or excluded. And when they get to college, they find everything is marginalizing. They're told to find more things offensive. That's what a microaggression is. Find small things that you might have just overlooked before. Learn how to take offense to them. And come to see that the whole world is stacked against you. If you're a person of color, if you're a minority, we want you to feel that the world is entirely stacked against you, built to keep you down. Now, go have a nice day. Go be successful in the world. Yeah, good luck with that.
You know, one of the stories, in fact, I think there's a couple of them in the book, that in a sense made me laugh, but it's criminal really, about the mother who decided that her kid did need some confidence and needed to be able to go on a journey which was all planned. You know, he had a map, he knew where he's going, he had money, he knew who he could call in and ask for help to get from A to B. And people found out about this and she was sort of voted on social media as the worst mother in America because she'd let this young child out on his own. I mean, here's to her. Why don't we all send her some champagne?
Exactly. So her name is Lenore Skenazy. She wrote a wonderful book called Free Range Kids, and she is the patron saint of what I hope is the future of American child rearing. I love her. I and some others encouraged her to start a new organization. If any listeners, if you have young kids, please go to letgrow.org. You'll find all kinds of research and ideas for how to raise tougher, stronger kids. I think you're probably way ahead of us in Australia on that.
Don't bet on it.
That's what I'm worried about, is a lot of very bad social trends that start in America go a year later to the UK and then a year or two after that to Australia and New Zealand. So you might be seeing signs of these things coming, trigger warnings, microaggressions, safe spaces. If you do, I was about to say run the other way, but no, stand and fight.
Indeed. Jonathan Haidt, co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind, thank you very much for joining us once again on Counterpoint.
Oh, my pleasure, Amanda.
And we've put all the details of Jonathan's book on our website. Go to abc.net.au and follow the links to RN. Then under Programs, you'll find Counterpoint. Thanks for your company today. And until next week, I'm Amanda Vanstone. Ciao, ciao.